International sporting events can transform a city's skyline with new infrastructure and a country's economy with renewed investment. But has there ever been a tournament with such lofty expectations of social, political and legal change as the Qatar World Cup? From women's and LGBTQI plus rights to labour laws, emissions reductions, what changes has the World Cup actually brought to Qatar, and has the event been a net force for good? Luke Sidham-Dundon reports.
Even before we reach halftime at the World Cup, officials, journalists and even sports ministers from Spain have touted the tournament's potential to have a positive impact on Qatari society.
I am convinced that in Qatar, freedom and tolerance will increase after this World Cup.
So, has the Cup influenced women's and workers' rights, the treatment of LGBTQI plus people, and even the climate? Here's FIFA President Gianni Infantino's ambitious promise at last year's COP26 summit.
We reconfirmed our joint pledge to make this next major tournament fully carbon neutral.
That's essentially greenwashing, and it amounts to misleading advertisement.
Gilles Dufresne investigated FIFA's emissions promises for non-for-profit group Carbon Market Watch and found they'd oversold claims of carbon neutrality.
FIFA says that the World Cup will emit 3.6 million tonnes of CO2. We think we've calculated upwards of 5 million.
From investing in solar and electric public transport upgrades, Qatar's also sought to reduce FIFA's footprint by purchasing carbon credits from a registry established in Doha. But experts like Gilles claim the credits are questionable because he believes the carbon-reducing projects they fund would have existed even without FIFA's financing.
These projects are viable and economically profitable in most regions around the world, so they don't need to sell these carbon credits in order to exist. And so basically all the credits that FIFA is buying are not really making any difference to global emissions because they're coming from projects that will exist anyway.
So, clearly questions remain on the Cup's climate impact. But what about the treatment of workers in Qatar? The Guardian reports 6,500 migrant workers died there in the decade since the World Cup was awarded. And while the death records used to collect those figures don't mention how workers died, it's likely many were employed to work on World Cup infrastructure projects, all in time for kickoff. Doha has long disputed that figure, but this week, Hassan Al-Dawadi, the events boss in Qatar, finally gave his estimate on how many World Cup-related construction deaths there might have been.
The estimate is around 400. Between 400 and 500, I don't have the exact number.
In 2018, the International Labour Organization set up their Doha office on invitation of the Qatar government. I asked their chief, Max Tunyon, how conditions had improved since their arrival.
One of the key things that we've been looking at how to do is to really dismantle the most problematic elements of the kafala system. This is a system which really tied one worker to an employer, which created space for exploitation. With the dismantling of the most problematic elements of kafala, there's also been changes in the introduction of a minimum wage, also laws that better protect workers during the summer months when they're outdoor workers.
Well, just on wages, as well as a fund for unpaid labour, Qatar claims to have repaid tens of millions of dollars in recruitment fees that workers were slugged with over the last decade. It still doesn't answer the question, though, of quite literally stolen wages. Last month, the ABC spoke with an Indian worker who'd waited 7 years to be paid for a year's work after being deported for demanding that he get paid. To what extent do you think Qatar allowed or even facilitated mass wage theft?
Well, I don't think the government has facilitated this process by any means.
Well, just coming back to what you mentioned earlier, on heat restrictions, Qatar's expanded bans on summer work in the middle of the day, but reporting from The Guardian found morning and afternoon work was still unsafe and leading to high levels of fatalities every year. How did the government arrive at these expanded rules?
This legislation is actually based on the most comprehensive research that's ever been done on occupational heat stress. From the 1st of June to the 15th of September, from 10 a.m. to 3:30 p.m., all outdoor work is prohibited. And if you add up all of those prohibited hours, it comes to around 588 hours. That is more than double the number of prohibited hours that exist in the legislation in some of the neighbouring countries, in Saudi Arabia, in UAE, and Bahrain.
Sorry to jump in, but isn't comparing Qatar's labour laws to its neighbours applying an incredibly low bar that wouldn't really be used elsewhere by the ILO?
I think we have to, you know, look at the progress that has been made over time. The process of adopting legislation, building institutions, changing mindsets and business practices that have been deeply entrenched for decades is a process. We are on a very positive trajectory that needs to continue beyond the World Cup.
Max Tounion there from the International Labour Organization's Qatar office. One area where all sides generally agree there's no good news is improving rights for Qatar's LGBTQI plus population. Last month, Qatar's first publicly gay person, Dr. Naz Mohammed, who now lives in the US, told RN Breakfast what queer Qataris faced back home.
Ill treatment in detention, physical torture and conversion practices.
Rosna Begum is a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch, specialising in the Middle East. She says despite Doha saying it would welcome LGBTQI plus fans from abroad, the safety of that community in Qatar is still under threat.
Tolerance is really reserved for visitors and not for the people who live at home. And at the same time, they are going out of their way to arrest people who are LGBT for their gender expression and to abuse them during detention.
And what about the autonomy of women, given male guardianship laws prevent them from travelling, marrying and even working certain jobs without a man's permission?
In essence, these rules leave women as legal minors in their own country. Women still are quite hopeful with the World Cup taking place and the spotlight on the country. And there are also women who don't enjoy the fact that there is an orientalist gaze on the country, you know, recognising the fact that while women are fighting and contending with discriminatory rules, they are also women who are highly achieving women in many respects. And so trying to get that nuance in is quite incredibly important.
So yes, there is hope. There has been some progress. But at what cost?
That report by Luke Sidham Dundon, and you're listening to RN Breakfast.
ABC RN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.